Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Here at Wyoming Public Radio, we report a lot on the energy industry. We've looked at how it affects the environment and what it does for local communities and the state's economy. Today, we'll be taking a more in-depth look at how industry is regulated. We're dedicating today's entire show to that topic.
We'll look at how state and federal agencies protect air quality from industry emissions, and we'll examine what some see as loopholes in those safeguards.
We'll hear why companies are often not fined for spills, and we'll learn about the state's collaborative approach to cleaning up contaminated sites.
We start off today's show with a look at the agency that's in charge of protecting the environment in Wyoming. Much of our reporting in the past has led us to conversations with angry landowners and folks who have concerns about industry's effects on the environment and human health. As you'll hear in this show, the concerned parties are not always satisfied with the answers regulators provide. But before we get into that, we wanted to give regulators an opportunity to have their say. Well, Public Radio's Irina Zhorov spoke with the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, Todd Parfit. The DEQ is in charge of regulating many aspects of industrial production in the state. Irina, what did you find out?
Todd Parfit started out by reading DEQ's mission statement, which is to protect, conserve, and enhance the quality of Wyoming's environment for the benefit of current and future generations. In a recent public hearing in Fort Laramie about an oil loading facility, an attendee actually read this mission statement back to those present, saying she didn't think the agency was really abiding by its mandate. So I asked Parfit how exactly the agency works towards those goals.
We have standards in place for both for water quality and for air quality. And when we issue permits, we ensure that those permits are protective of those standards. Now, on the compliance, inspection, and monitoring, we establish inspection schedules for the year and ensure that we're doing a fair amount of inspections to ensure compliance. And then where we do see noncompliance, then we follow that up with enforcement actions if necessary. Both in the air and water quality, we have monitoring efforts to assess the ambient conditions and to ensure that the permits that we've issued are actually protective of those resources. And then lastly, it's reclamation. We have reclamation requirements.
So what we've heard over the years as we interviewed people is that often the standards and monitoring efforts and all that weren't satisfactory. People sometimes feel as if the agency is doing the bare minimum for people and concentrating a lot more on what industry needs. Parfit did not agree with that.
The standards that we establish for air and water and for all of our programs when we establish rules, there's a certain process that we go through to ensure that there's opportunity for public input throughout that process, as well as the industry. And so in that process, we'll put out drafts for comment and take comments on those when we're talking about rulemaking.
He says permits are also opened up to public comment, and the DEQ holds public hearings. Indeed, Parfit set off for a public hearing in Douglas as soon as our interview was over. Of course, the agency doesn't have to adopt all suggestions, which probably leaves some people without resolution.
A citizen complaint I've heard is that the agency tends to be more reactive than proactive.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And actually, in November, I heard Todd Parfit speak at the Energy Law Conference at the University of Wyoming. He was talking about claims that groundwater was contaminated by fracking. Here's what he said at the time.
DEQ gets involved when there is a problem. So when we do have contamination of groundwater, that's when the DEQ gets involved in the process.
When we talked more recently, he had this to say.
I would say that we are being proactive. We have established a baseline groundwater monitoring program outside of what the Oil and Gas Commission had just recently passed and will become effective in March. We've been working with the United States Geological Survey and offering to have certain wells in what we would view as areas of the state where there might be high levels of activity, where we want to have a better handle on what the background conditions are. It's not as comprehensive as the Oil and Gas Commission rules that just passed, but it does focus in on areas of high development where we offer to residents the opportunity to participate in that program at no cost, where we'll collect the background information.
He also mentioned the agency's network of air quality monitors.
We do an evaluation of our monitoring network every year, and we determine where we need to have monitors. For example, last year we through that assessment, we determined that it would be appropriate to have a monitor up in the Converse County area. That assessment, again, this year led us to the conclusion that we needed to continue to have that mobile monitor in Converse County. I don't know what our conclusion will be next year, but we'll look at the results of that monitoring effort and determine if we need a permanent monitor or not.
You'll hear later in the show that monitoring is one of the things that folks living in areas with a lot of development bring up. DQ says they're already going above and beyond when it comes to monitoring and that they are constrained by money at times from doing more.
I'd imagine budget constraints are not limited to monitors either.
That's right. I've heard that from DQ people in reference to a variety of things. It's also the reason they rely on industry to do some self-monitoring in addition to their own inspections. So I asked Parfit about whether DQ is proactive in trying to get more funds when they feel they're needed.
Every year we have an opportunity to present to the governor and to the legislature a budget request. And we actually go through every year and assess all of our programs and determine whether or not we have adequate resources or whether or not we have too many resources in a particular area if we have a program that's phasing out. So we do that assessment every year to determine whether or not we have adequate resources. And as an example, I'll just point out that since 2004, the agencies had a net increase of 53 FTEs, full-time employees. And that is a result of our agency going through and assessing our needs in all of our programs.
So does he think the agency is sufficiently funded right now?
Here's what he says.
We do have adequate resources as we stand in terms of full-time employees. We do have an exception request for some additional funds in air quality, but by and large, it's pretty much a status quo budget request.
Their new requests will mostly be related to modeling projects. Parfit says that as with anything, much of the agency's work is a balancing act, usually involving budget limitations and the agency's responsibilities. For example, I threw out another complaint we hear often that there aren't enough inspections happening at industrial sites to make sure they're functioning as they should be.
As far as having people on the ground and inspectors and our inspection process to ensure that we have compliance with permitting activities, you have the spectrum. You know, we've got thousands of outfalls or emission points, and it's not practical to have an individual or staff person every one of these outfalls or emission points. The other end of the spectrum would be not to have anybody overseeing the activity. So we have not only our inspectors going out to these facilities and ensuring compliance, but we also have the self-monitoring that, and the information that comes into us from the regulated community.
So Parfit thinks that overall, the DQ is getting that balance right and is doing so with their mission in mind.
All right. Thank you very much, Irina.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll look at how air quality is monitored in Wyoming and why some feel the state's monitoring system is insufficient. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. We've reported often on the effects that energy production can have on air quality. The most obvious example is Pinedale, where federal ambient air quality standards were violated, largely because of emissions from natural gas production. Regulators say the air elsewhere in the state is fine, but some worry that Wyoming does not have a sufficient monitoring network to know for sure. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
I'm standing outside the air quality monitoring station in Converse County with Amber Potts. She works for the Department of Environmental Quality. The station is in an open field in an area with lots of new oil production.
You can see a rig, you know, out on the horizon. You can see the well pads.
The monitoring station is a big white trailer equipped with various instruments that take in air samples. Inside, machines analyze how clean the air is. They monitor for particulate matter like dust, and also for pollutants such as ozone.
Right now, our ozone is 35.5 or 35.4. That's a good background concentration for this area.
The Environmental Protection Agency regulates ambient air quality, which is a fancy name for how clean the air is. They impose limits on various different pollutants with the idea that if pollution levels are below the limit, the air is safe to breathe. In Wyoming, DEQ is in charge of monitoring to determine if those standards are met. They have 35 monitoring stations across the state. Except for one in Sublette County, where ozone levels have been a problem, all indicate that air quality is satisfactory. But are 35 monitors enough to really know that the air is okay everywhere?
In theory, at least, the planning process is designed to ensure that there are an adequate number of monitors and that violations that may be occurring of the ambient air quality standards are being identified and then being addressed through the plan.
That's Mark Squillaci at the University of Colorado Law School. He specializes in natural resource law, and the plan he's referring to is the network plan that DEQ has to draw up each year. It lays out where all the monitors are and explains why monitors are needed in those areas. EPA then has to sign off on the plan. But Squillaci says EPA's requirements for what the plan has to include are vague.
It's not entirely clear where those monitors are supposed to be or how many monitors they have to have.
Squillaci says it's in the state's interest to not violate the standards, but it can also be in their interest to not detect violations.
There are some significant consequences to the state when they fail to meet the ambient air quality standards. You're basically not allowed to build major new facilities in any area that's out of compliance without meeting very stringent standards. And so one could argue that the state has an incentive to avoid identifying areas that are out of compliance.
In states like Wyoming, EPA is even more hands-off about network requirements than in some other areas. Kara Kessler is in charge of DEQ's air quality monitoring program.
Usually what they're most concerned about is population. So a lot of times Wyoming doesn't end up having to put new monitors out based on EPA regulations because they look for populations, say, over a million in a city or something like that.
And Wyoming has fewer than 600,000 people statewide. Kessler says Wyoming's monitoring network goes above and beyond what EPA requires. She says they're committed to making sure that the air is clean and that if there were any exceedances of federal standards, they would know. But there are 10 counties in Wyoming with no air quality monitors. I asked her how they know the air is okay in those places. Kessler says they make assumptions based on how much development is in the area and trends they've seen elsewhere.
If we don't have a lot of emissions out there, you know, then we kind of are forced to assume that it's okay.
There are additional assumptions DEQ makes. For example, some of their monitors are mobile units, which typically get moved around each year. But you need 3 years of data to determine whether an area meets ozone standards. Kessler says if pollution levels are low for the 1 year that the monitor is in place, DEQ generally assumes the air is okay. If they see any alarming data, they can consider installing a permanent monitor. But Kessler says budget constraints can make that difficult.
If we need to put something new out, you don't have any choice but to take something else away.
Take something else away, as in remove a monitoring station from somewhere else in the state.
That is a problem. Because the places where the monitors exist, I think we need them.
Jill Morrison is with the Powder River Basin Resource Council. She notes that energy production is increasing rapidly in many parts of the state, and she says air quality monitoring should mirror that activity.
You know, we need an expansion of the entire air quality monitoring network in the state. And DEQ needs to look at a way to manage their budget where they can increase the numbers of air monitors we've got.
Morrison says the monitoring should include not just areas where there's already lots of development, but also baseline testing in places where future development could occur.
One of the problems, I think, is that we don't get out in front of issues in order to prevent them from happening. Instead, we wait for the problem to occur, and then we try to marshal the forces and the funding to be able to address it after the fact.
But since monitors cost hundreds of thousands of dollars apiece, it's not likely that DEQ will significantly expand their network unless they can come up with more money. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Some landowners with oil and gas wells on their property complain about emissions affecting their air quality and health. But though there may be a lot of wells, they are considered small facilities, so their cumulative effects are never counted up, and regulations are more lax than for large emitters. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports that could be a problem, since in aggregate, their pollution can be significant.
On a chilly day last spring, John Fenton stood on a sandy bluff overlooking his property in Pavilion, a small natural gas well set atop the little hill.
There's two well heads here. And then a produced water tank. And then these are the separators that take the liquids out of the gas rather than put them into the tank.
The wind whipped around him as he spoke, and his dog came barreling up the hill.
What's he barking at?
He's barking at the pump where the gas is coming out because he doesn't like the noise it makes. So
Fenton said with each click of the pump, natural gas is released into the air.
And the wind's blowing a little bit today, but if we get closer, you can definitely smell it. It's that sharp kind of like nail polish smell. It's the best way to describe it, I guess. It'll give you a headache if you get a smell of it. So it's probably not real good for you.
Benton says the problem is how these small facilities are permitted.
Each one of these is permitted by itself. So it's not a major source. It's a real easy way to just kind of avoid the bigger picture.
There are small sources and big major sources, which emit over 100 tons of any regulated pollutant per year. Major sources are more carefully scrutinized and can be analyzed in aggregate by regulators. Here's Air Quality Administrator for the Department of Environmental Quality, Steve Dietrich.
The way the Clean Air Act is set up and the way our authority works for minor sources, if you're a minor source, that kind of analysis is generally not required.
Additionally, some sources in the area are so small that their emission rate is not high enough to even warrant controls. Control means emissions have to be reduced by 98% or better, usually through a flare or some other capture or combustion process. If the facility is below the control threshold, it can just release pollutants into the air. The threshold is quite low. According to the DEQ, there are nearly 300 small, uncontrolled sites around Pavilion. WPR requested emissions data from several wells in that region. If we assume that their emission rates are about average, that means in aggregate, the uncontrolled wells in Pavilion are releasing over 500 tons of volatile organic compounds per year, all told. That's more than five major sources would emit. To put this into perspective, that's nearly twice as much as Wyoming's largest coal-fired power plant emitted in 2010. And that's only for volatile organic compounds. There are other pollutants, too. But DEQ doesn't add up the emissions from these small sources. Dietrich says there's a reason for that.
They're all small. They're not owned by the same company all the time. They may not be linked together on the same piece of property. And those are all the criteria that we have to go through to see if it's even possible to lump them together. And it's specifically set up that way so that you don't end up with such a cumbersome permitting program that you never get to issue any permits.
I don't think that permitting should be the issue. I think that protecting public health and our air quality should be the issue.
That's Deb Thomas, an organizer with the Powder River Basin Resource Council. She says she hears people in oil and gas development areas complain of headaches, breathing difficulties, respiratory ailments, nose polyps, ear problems, dizziness, loss of taste and smell, as well as things like neuropathy, nervous disorders, cancers, and kidney and liver conditions.
I think most people understand that there are many different factors that cause some of those conditions, but because we're seeing a lot of those conditions in the areas where development is taking place, and because we know that many of the chemicals and the hydrocarbons that are produced can cause many of those conditions and illnesses, it's very important for people to understand what those exposures are.
Thomas was one of the people that fought to get an ambient air monitor into Pavilion. After a year of monitoring, it showed no exceedances of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. The monitor sat downwind of the gas field, about 6 miles east of Pavilion.
Though it gave a good cumulative idea of what the air quality was in that area, outside of Pavilion and outside of the area that's under heavy development, it did not explain to people what they're exposed to who are living right in the contamination, right in the production areas.
Which is exactly where John Fenton lives. You can see several wells from his front porch where he relaxes, and they're scattered in the fields where he works. Fenton isn't the only one with industrial facilities right in his yard. But DEQ's Kara Kessler says the monitor did its job.
I believe the Pavilion monitor achieved our objective of looking at what the citizens are breathing in terms of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards and if we were meeting those.
However, Kessler says that such ambient air monitoring isn't really even designed to do exposure assessments of contaminants to people. According to her, that's a different study, different pollutants, and a different agency's responsibility. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
When we come back, we'll hear why companies are usually not penalized for spills, and we'll talk with an economist about what it means for industry if you impose new regulations. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. If you're just tuning in now, this is a special on regulation of the energy industry. Wyoming's biggest export is soda ash, which comes from Trona mines in Sweetwater County. Last year, the Trona industry produced 17 million tons of soda ash, for which the state received nearly $90 million in various taxes and royalties. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports, the industry has a dirty side, too.
Wyoming is used to superlatives. The biggest coal bed, the largest mine, the most wind. Here's another.
The Sylvan Retreats of Wyoming, USA is home to the world's largest reserve of Trona.
The largest Trona deposit. That's a video from one of the companies that mine Trona. Aside from another small mine in California, the four facilities in southwestern Wyoming are the Trona industry in the U.S.
We now produce about 90% of all the soda ash used in the United States and about 25% of all the soda ash used in the world.
That's Marion Loomis, director of the Wyoming Mining Association.
About 85% of the value of what Wyoming exports out of the United States is soda ash.
Trona is used to produce sodium carbonate, which is used in everything from glass production, paper, and baking soda. But the industry that produces these innocuous everyday products is also a big polluter. It's one of the biggest emitters of volatile organic compounds and hazardous air pollutants among big sources in the state. Most of the facilities are also in the top 10 list of emitters for nitrogen oxides. Bruce Pendery lives in Utah but works for the Wyoming Outdoor Council and has made the drive through the Trona Patch in southwest Wyoming on his way to Cheyenne dozens of times.
You can see the plumes of smoke stretching out from the various plants and covering really quite a wide area.
He says the pollution he sees around the Trona plant seems worse than the coal-fired power plants he also passes. Pendery's observations are anecdotal, but on the day of my visit to the FMC Trona facility, the horizon was also heavy with dull gray columns. John Lucas is FMC's environmental team leader, and he navigated through the huge industrial site's many stacks.
Basically, what you're seeing is primarily water vapor. About 99% of our emissions at FMC are water vapor and some carbon dioxide. The other 1% of our emissions are methane from safely venting the mine, from natural occurring methane, and then other process-related emissions.
Those process-related emissions adhere to complicated permitting from the Department of Environmental Quality. DEQ says getting emissions down is a process. Lucas says one way it's done is the best available control technology, or BACT review, which is done when they modify or add operations.
They'll look around across the industry and find the best available control technology, and that's what they'll apply.
The idea is that as technology gets better, emissions will get lower. But there may be other holes. For example, there are also maximum achievable control technology, or MACT, standards that the EPA promulgates to control hazardous air pollutants for new and existing sources. But for the most part, the EPA never developed any MACT standards for the Trona industry. And remember that methane Lucas mentioned? Those industrial sites sit on top of huge mazes of very gassy underground mines. FMC's Fred Von Aaron says large volumes of air are moved around the mines to vent them of the methane.
The real goal of the ventilation in the mine is to move fresh air in and keep fresh breathing air in there for the miners.
The Mine Safety and Health Administration requires this. The dirty air carrying methane, volatile organic compounds, and hazardous air pollutants gets pumped up to the atmosphere through a vent.
The bulk of the VOCs and HAPs comes from the shales that are in the mine themselves.
In other words, those vents contribute pollution, but they're not controlled. Here's the DEQ's Cole Anderson.
It's important to note that air quality regulates sources that essentially from the ground level and up, we do not regulate mines or underground mines.
In past operating permits for the Trona companies, DEQ listed the mine vents as sources of emissions, but usually did not list how much they emit or any permits that apply to them. Still, VOC and HAP emissions are included in DEQ's inventory, but methane is not. Jeremy Nichols, Climate and Energy Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians, has been looking at the issue of methane emissions from coal mines. He says there are no specific regulations dealing with methane venting for mines, but the permits still strike him as odd.
It seems to me that Wyoming needs to be making sure these trona mines are starting to report their emissions and ensure that they're being accounted for through their permits. I mean, they have to at least come clean and say, okay, from our ventilation system, this is how many tons per year of methane are being released.
There's another issue, too. If pollution is being pumped into the atmosphere and things like methane aren't even accounted for, how do nearby residents know their air is okay? That's usually done with monitoring. Kara Kessler works in DEQ's monitoring division.
The state doesn't have any monitors at the trona facilities right now.
There hasn't been one in Green River within the last 10 years either. This spring, DEQ did install an ambient air monitor in Rock Springs, about 40 miles downwind of the facilities.
Actually, looking at the emissions, we were more concerned about oil and gas growth closer to Rock Springs than trona.
Data from the monitor does not show any legal exceedances so far, but there have been short-term spikes in particulate concentrations. The trona companies have monitors too, though they only monitor one pollutant, particulates. If it seems like the trona industry is getting by with less regulations and checks than other industries, Nancy Veer, who represented the DEQ's Air Quality Division out of the Attorney General's office for a decade, says that's an illusion. She says Wyoming has solid regulations.
My understanding is that most of the trona being mined in the United States is virtually all from Wyoming, and there's only several facilities that are doing it. So that may be why the federal government has not promulgated regulations specific to trona. But that does not mean that trona is going unregulated.
And FMC's Von Aaron says if you compare the whole trona industry to the whole oil and gas industry, for example, trona's emissions are much smaller. Plus, he says, trona's just different.
The trona itself is a very pure mineral. It's a pretty benign chemical.
That may be true, but producing that benign chemical can be dirty business. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Wyoming regulators recorded hundreds of spills by the oil and gas industry last year, but issued just a handful of fines. As Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, that's actually not unusual.
Jeannie McMullen knows when there's been an oil spill from the production wells on her goat farm in the Bighorn Basin.
There's a spill. It's a sharp smell. It's a burning smell to my senses, my nose, my eyes, my lungs.
McMullen and her husband bought the property a decade ago with full knowledge that there were wells on it. She says they figured the wells would be little trouble, but that turned out not to be the case.
Within the first week, we walked the property, and down on the bottom, we found one flow line leak, well tie-in in between the two wells themselves, flowing all over the pastures.
Since then, McMullen says there's been at least one spill every year, including one in 2010 that went on for 2 weeks before anyone responded. She says they report the spills to all of the regulatory agencies, but that they keep happening.
After so many spills, they started coming out. We had, seven, eight people standing around discussing different options, but to no avail. I mean, it's still going on.
And she says the agencies didn't actually follow up to make sure the required cleanup happened.
You take some of the dirt down there, wad it up in a ball, and it stays in a ball because it's so full of oil. And this isn't just one or two little patches. It's large areas. Try and grow anything on that. Having goats, we'd welcome weeds, but a lot of that doesn't even grow weeds down there.
McMullen doesn't have much hope that the spills will stop without some regulatory prodding. She'd like to see big fines with that money put towards reclamation. But in 2013, the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality issued only a handful of fines, mostly for intentional dumping. And the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission issued no fines. Commission Natural Resources Program Supervisor Tom Kropach says it doesn't make sense to fine companies for spills that happen because a pipe freezes or a valve malfunctions.
Some of these unintentional spills, I'm not sure that, you know, a fine would really be a deterrent to something that an operator wasn't trying to cause in the first place.
In light of that, Kropach says the commission is focused on making sure an operator reports the spill and does appropriate cleanup. He says when spills aren't cleaned up, then the commission levies fines.
The last fine that the commission had ordered was in 2011, and that was for spills and a couple other issues that the company had on compliance with the rules, but mainly because there was no response on cleanup of the site.
The Department of Environmental Quality takes a similar approach. Joe Hunter is the Emergency Response Coordinator. He says a lot of spills happen in winter when there's freezing and thawing of equipment.
Companies have really taken it upon themselves to try to upgrade their equipment. I think they're doing a pretty good job of policing themselves. Unfortunately, you know, these things are going to happen. It's nature of the beast.
Hunter says spills are on the rise in Wyoming with increasing oil and gas production, but because of recent changes in record keeping, it's hard to say for sure. So I asked if they use the data they collect to analyze how the spills are happening and how to prevent them in the future.
We have. We've suggested, you know, using heat traces and things like that on valves and things that regularly freeze and break.
So you've made those suggestions, but they're not enforceable.
I don't believe we have any regulations to enforce that type of thing.
So where does that leave landowners like the McMullins? Jeannie says she only sees one way that the spills are going to stop.
We hope and we pray that they just go dry, go away, make them just go away.
The wells on the McMullins' land are old, and the day when that happens may actually be fairly close. But others may not be so lucky. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
For many years, Wyoming lawmakers have been reluctant to impose new regulations on industry. At the national level, the congressional delegation has been highly critical. Anytime the Environmental Protection Agency proposes new regulations on energy production, saying that it costs jobs. State leaders have echoed those statements, and over the years, many legislators have even expressed concern about adding staff to the Department of Environmental Quality, fearing that could lead to overregulation.
In many cases, the thinking is that if you add regulations and make it tougher for industry to operate, industry will leave. So we asked economist Roger Coupel at UW's Department of Ag and Applied Economics whether that's true.
Environmental regulations or regulations in general, you know, on one level, sure. You know, if it costs less because of lower regulations someplace else and it costs more here, then there may be the possibility that they would move someplace else, especially given the pervasiveness of gas. That said, I guess I don't buy the notion that most of the reason why everybody left the oil and gas left Wyoming in terms of the number of rigs is because of regulation. It's because the product that they're getting out of the Marcellus or these shale plays around the country are in an area of the oil and gas markets that's most lucrative.
Obviously, not all regulations are created equal. What types of regulations tend to have more impact on where industry decides to locate?
Yeah. Well, clearly what goes on here in Wyoming, where a substantial percentage of the land is federal and a substantial percentage of the subsurface ownership is federal. You know, NEPA, environmental impact analysis, become that whole planning issue, public process is a major issue. To do an environmental impact analysis can take, that planning effort can take anywhere from 5 to 10 years. Well, that's a lot of money that the industry has to pay. And so it's a lot of times easier for firms to start with private land or with state land, where it's a little easier to work with local authorities than to go to federal lands. That said, just because you don't have National Environmental Protection Act and the Council of Environmental Quality rules and all that stuff running in places where it's primarily private land, you have other regulatory issues. If you look at, for example, where a lot of these shale plays are occurring, you know, the Bakken, the Marcellus, and Barnett and others, they're in areas where the surface is more intensively managed, cropland, residential development even. You know, you have more people per square mile than you would have here. Well, when you start messing with people's land and water, they're going to bring up a different set of regulatory issues, but they're still just as problematic from the industry perspective. And those could slow down. In fact, they have slowed down the Marcellus to a certain extent.
So you're dealing with you're essentially dealing with different kinds of you have more of one kind of regulation under one circumstance, more of a different kind of hurdle to deal with in another.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so if they're moving in that, what that suggests to me anyway is that the movement of oil and gas rigs out of Wyoming into these plays probably doesn't have a whole lot to do with regulation per se, because you might have more state level and local level regulation and political oversight there. It has to do with what they're getting out of it. And that's where they're because they're making more money there than they would here.
So essentially, it may be worth it for companies to go to a place with tougher regulations just because the resource is better there.
Right.
So speaking of money, how big an impact can things like tax policy have? I mean, if you offer tax incentives to energy companies, does that make a big difference in terms of where they decide to drill?
It can, but I don't think it makes a big difference. At least I've never seen any kind of research that would suggest that that's the case. The problem with that saying yes is that you could potentially get a race to the bottom whereby everybody's either subsidizing either one way or another everybody else. And so, you know, let's say the Bakken starts subsidizing development there. You know, the whole idea is to build your state government coffers, not deplete them. So it's not clear in the long run that you could actually do that in a way that actually makes sense in terms of fiscal responsibility.
So if you were giving advice to Wyoming policymakers, and if their goal is let's keep the energy industry strong in Wyoming or make it stronger, what regulatory advice would you give them?
Well, you know, we need to work with these industries to look at where the regulatory risks are. I mean, it's fine to talk about reforming the Endangered Species Act or NEPA or things like that, but the reality is that we have NEPA and we have the Endangered Species Act. So trying to figure out ways to solve some of these issues that some of these regulations look at is a way to do that, you know, to help not so much provide subsidies, but provide ways to help them to help these industries to understand how to solve some of these problems before they become a political problem like the sage grouse.
Roger, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear how contaminated sites get cleaned up in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. There are a number of contaminated sites across the state that are expensive to clean up. The contamination comes from a variety of sources, including industrial sites and businesses that use chemicals. Because of the cost and rigorous standards, it was difficult to get these sites cleaned up in a timely manner. Several years ago, the state decided to make it easier for companies to clean up the contamination. They did this through two programs. Those involved say it has led to quicker cleanup and provided communities with economic opportunities. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Wyoming's voluntary remediation program allows companies who report their contamination to work with the state to develop a collaborative plan to clean up the contamination. The Department of Environmental Quality's Jerry Breed is in charge of the program.
As long as they comply with the remedy agreement and conduct the cleanup, we agree that we won't sue them for anything else. Once they've completed that cleanup, they get a certificate of completion, and that's the only program in the state where they can get that kind of assurance from the state.
That certificate makes the property attractive to potential developers. The other benefit to the companies is that they can restore contaminated land to a much lower standard than if they weren't in the program. Bob Conlin is overseeing Chevron's cleanup of what is known as the Old Texaco Refinery near Casper. Conlin says the slightly reduced standards allows the cleanup to move a lot more quickly.
We have reached the commercial industrial standards on the soil, and we're in the process of developing our final groundwater remedy for DEQ in the property, which will take a number of years to remediate.
Commercial standards are less rigorous than residential standards. However, Conlin does not believe that companies are being let off the hook.
It is a highly regulated process. Like I said, you write work plans, you go out and do the work, and then you write a final report on that particular aspect.
Conlin says the cleanup of the refinery property could be a showcase for what a successful remediation effort looks like. He notes that a wind farm has been erected on part of the property, and the southern portion of the property has been sold to a local developer. The DEQ's Vicki Meredith oversees another effort known as brownfields, where communities can get money to restore some abandoned industrial sites, clean them up, and use them. She mentions an old sawmill site in Dubois, and Evanston's Roundhouse and Rail Yard as two examples where the program is working well and communities will gain.
Those are two kind of industrial sites that have that would have just basically sit there and gotten rocks thrown at them and, you know, laid idle and not been put into productive reuse because the local government didn't have the ability to investigate or clean up those properties.
Former Evanston City employee Jim Davis worked on the Roundhouse project. He says it allowed the city to pay for expensive water monitoring. When it was proven that the water was clean, it allowed the community to get an additional $12 million to clean up the site and develop a community center and a convention center.
I want to emphasize that the buildings are used all the time. In fact, they're almost booked a year in advance for all kinds of public events, weddings, private events, as well as conventions.
Meredith adds that both programs really help communities.
You know, industry does have some benefit, you know, with the incentives, but really it's provided these communities with these nice redeveloped properties that wouldn't have never been redeveloped had the law not been put in place.
The DEQ says hundreds of sites have been and are being cleaned up through these programs, and as word gets out, more companies are getting involved in the programs. Meredith says in the past, many of those sites would not have gotten cleaned up because companies often did not report the contamination and could not afford to clean it up to previous standards. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Regulation has been a hot-button topic when it comes to worker safety in Wyoming over the last few years. Despite pressure from worker advocacy groups, legislators have been reluctant to write new laws penalizing companies for workplace injuries and fatalities, instead opting for an incentives-based approach. Dr. Max Sewell is the state's occupational epidemiologist. He's been on the job for about a year and a half, and he recently spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce about his latest report on workplace accidents, released in November, and how the state should move forward.
The legislature has been reluctant to pass new regulations related to workplace safety. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on how this data that you're compiling is useful without new regulation.
Well, I do think it helps industries target the kinds of circumstances that may lead to injuries. I think the legislature and the governor have both done a couple of things. One is the legislature, you know, added seven new positions to the OSHA staff. That's really a significant increase in their capacity. And, of course, the other thing they've done is they created a workplace safety fund, and they have also created an incentive program for workers' compensation for those employers that have a safety program.
A lot of people have broken that down as the legislature and the governor opting for a carrot approach as opposed to a stick. Which one do you feel is more effective?
OSHA has the ability already to provide the stick. I mean, they have the authority to levy penalties. You know, I'm sure you saw the news where Sinclair was just hit with a substantial penalty. You know, I think there's more than one way to motivate human behavior. And, you know, I just think it's the legislature and the governor have got to decide the best approach for that.
And in your role as the occupational epidemiologist, how do you measure the efficacy of those various approaches?
Well, my job is to look at the data and to provide data runs to various groups, including the governor and the citizens of Wyoming. I do see some encouraging trends. I do think it's going to take time, though.
You mentioned the program that hired seven new workplace safety consultants. with the idea being that companies can reach out for voluntary inspections rather than waiting to be fined after an accident. Are companies actually using that program?
Yes, they are. The one advantage to the voluntary program is if an employer says, well, hey, it's just a matter of time before my number comes up, they can reach out to OSHA and get a review without being penalized. And so I think that's a successful model.
I guess, how are you going about measuring the efficacy of that program?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm actually measuring the efficacy of that. You might want to talk with OSHA directly about that. But I think it just makes sense that there was a substantial increase in the number of OSHA staff who were dedicated towards inspections with these additional staff. And I think that was really remarkable that the legislature did that.
So that's not an area that you're focused on at all? Whether the solutions that are being implemented are actually working?
What I see happening is that there are a bunch of solutions being tried all at once. And, you know, we're not trying to set up a rigorous scientific experiment. We're trying to just get some changes. For example, the Transportation Coalition, we know that there are some hazardous highway segments, and we're working on specific highway segments with the Transportation Department at the table, trying to make changes in either highway design or signage. The other thing, industry is at the table, so we're trying to get ahead of the curve so that the Transportation Department can make changes for access if they know that an industry is going to get busy in a certain area. For example, there's a lot of new activity up around Douglas.
Okay, so you're saying that there's a lot of approaches being tried out, but there's no way of measuring how successful they are.
I think it's a very complex question that you ask. I mean, we know, for example, that highway fatalities are down for 13, and I haven't seen the latest number, but we know they're way down. And the question is, well, why is that? There are probably a number of things that are contributing to that. And so I don't want to just say that it's one thing. I think, and I need to work with the various other groups so that we can try to make sense of some of this.
And I guess, you know, that leads me to the question, what for you is the biggest area that needs to be focused on here in Wyoming when it comes to workplace safety?
Well, I would say transportation, followed by construction. And then I think there are a number of other industries that would fall right behind that. Oil and gas would be there. You know, if you look at the workers' comp data, and again, some industries may not have a lot of fatalities, but they have a lot of injuries. Healthcare is an example. Accommodation and food services is another area. So I think this department, we're trying to find ways to reach out to these various organizations as we have time and the ability to pull these groups together.
And from what you've seen so far, do you think we're making progress in the right direction?
One of the things that motivated me about taking the job in the first place was the fact that I got a sense that there are a lot of people really do want to make some changes. And I do see some encouraging signs in terms of the drop in the number of deaths and the drop in the number of workers' comp claims. We think one death is too many, and so that's why we're pursuing multiple different strategies.
All right, Dr. Sewell, thank you so much for your time.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce speaking with State Occupational Epidemiologist Dr. Max Sewell.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and other types of information, you can follow all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.